At 23 and a half minutes after the hour on this Tuesday morning, we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and a very good friend of the station. We learned so much from Don, and he joins us just about every Tuesday morning. And it's going to sound a little different today because David is with us, but he's on his phone. And say something, David, so you can verify. Well, see if we can get you.
Something, David, so I can verify.
Okay, there you go. That's right.
How's that?
Yeah. David takes us so literally. And then there's Don Clark, who doesn't take us literally at all. He takes us scientifically. And we're going to take a look at what science is supposed to do, what it's designed to do, its role in the world. And then we're going to look at if we have time, we're going to get into some dinosaur footprints that have been found in Wales, the country Wales, not the kind that swim around. No. that would be revolutionary. So instead, well, this is the first time I've seen, and this is kind of a wimpy, mealy-mouthed definition of science, I think. Maybe you'll have some other ideas for us. This is the definition of science according to the Oxford English Dictionary. Science is, and I'll quote here, the intellectual and practical activity embracing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through both experiment and observation. Now, I could have stated that a lot more simply than they chose to there. What's your take, Don?
Well, you know, that's one aspect of science. I mean, yes, it is a systematic study, and it's interesting that they said, both through experiment. So we're looking at the natural world around us, and we're trying to make sense of it. And actually, that is quite biblical that we should do that, because we should explore God's creation. But if you don't have the correct starting assumptions, that is, God created the heavens and the earth, then you might come out with the wrong conclusion, and oftentimes they do. So the problem isn't necessarily what they're observing or what they're experimenting against. And of course, there's a whole nother area of science that they didn't even include in their definition, which is theoretical science, which is, I think, more mathematical than anything, where you assume, for example, that space is not linear, but that it is curved, and it is curved by the amount of matter in that particular space. So matter distorts space, and this was Einstein's theory, by the way. You come up with some mathematical expressions, and then you spend the rest of your life or eons of time trying to prove that your theoretical estimate as to what space is actually correct.
Now, theoretical, I presume, is opposed to the pursuit of science to a given end. For example, they've observed a problem, and they want to let's take a look at COVID. For example, here is a virus, and we need to take what we've learned about viruses and design something to alter the outcome of our connection with this new virus. That's less than theoretic, isn't it? Theoretical. Is that applied science? That must be applied science.
Yes, it's applied. Mm. It's applied science, not theoretical science. Mm. So, and we know a lot about the immune system, but we don't know everything about the immune system. And so in that case, they wanted to stimulate one aspect of the immune system to a particular protein on the virus, which, of course, is the spike protein. And thereby eliciting an antibody response to the spike protein, ultimately, which would then help protect you as long as the spike protein doesn't change in structure. But lo and behold, we are now into the fourth generation of the virus, and of course we know that the spike protein has changed quite a bit since the first introduction of the first vaccines. So we're still kind of using those vaccines, Pfizer has promised, for example, oh, we're going to revise the vaccine so it's going to be more specific to what's out there now. And then we start the cycle all over again. But that's applied science. It's not theoretical science where Einstein said, I think, space is distorted by matter. And so therefore, let me get a mathematician to help me figure out the math.
Yeah, I'm concerned that we conflate the two, theoretical and applied, because these days we seem to be bowing down to science as the end all and be all, the final word, the supreme authority. And I don't think it's ever intended to be that.
No, it's not. Pure science is really, whether it's theoretical or experimental or applied, it's designed. All it can do is describe or try to figure out how something works. Engineering is close to science because you have to use science in order to design something. But it would be, for example, the first time you see an automobile and you don't know where it came from, and you go about, trying to figure out, okay, well, how does this thing work? Oh, it's got this big, thing in the front. It's called an engine, or maybe it has an electric motor, and maybe there's batteries and all this other stuff. So then you go about taking it apart to figure out how it works. That's a gross simplification of what science is, but essentially it's kind of reversed engineering. But that's what we're trying to do with the world around us. We're trying to reverse engineer. The problem comes in when we, and ultimately when you draw conclusions, your conclusions are based on your assumptions. So if you assume that the world is flat and then you do some measurements, you say, aha, you see, I told you the world is flat, when indeed the world is round, and you just didn't get high enough up into space to figure out that, we live on a global planet, or maybe you didn't have a ship to take you out to the ends of the Earth, which, ultimately you would come around the other side of the Earth.
That's the significance of peer review, is it not? In other words, you can go out on a limb and make some scientific assertions. You can advance a theory, but then it's up to the rest of your fellow scientists to actually disprove your conclusion if they can. Isn't that the way it works?
Well, in the pure sense, that would be how it would work, and try to poke holes in your arguments. And that's the way it used to work, but apparently it doesn't work that way anymore, and we don't even have to wait till peer-reviewed, conclusions to come out. They just come out with them without actually sharing the data, which is the main problem that we have today, is we're just told this is the result, and you have to believe it whether it's true or not. And science gets corrupted by evil men, regardless of, pure science, of course, would be done with the all intentions of saying, look, here, I ran this experiment, or I built this thing, or I, put together this antigen whatever it is that you're trying to do. And here's my results, and here's all my data, here's my scientific method that I used, here's how I designed my experiment, here's my hypothesis, and here's the results. And leave it at that, and you can, maybe say, well, okay, this may have applications in other areas. But to go as far as people are going these days and just stretch the point beyond what the experiments actually have shown is we've gone way too far from basic science and have entered into metaphysics in some cases and just pure I want this result, so I'm just going to proclaim it, whether my data shows it or not.
You know, you're talking to a political science major here, and I'm trying to remember if in my college years I took anything even resembling science, connected to politics. There are certain things that maybe are best left alone by science, whether it's politics or maybe faith matters. Can science be applied to faith, for example?
Science can't be applied to faith, and the reason is because if you're looking at the natural world, faith goes beyond the natural world. And now you have to have faith in order to do your experiment. You have to have faith that, gee, I can do this experiment. And if somebody else tries to do the same experiment, they'll get the same result. That's part of validating whether or not your experiment, the way you did it, is valid, and the way the results come out are valid. But to go after faith or to say, hey, you know, I can prove whether or not God exists, that goes way beyond what science is, because science only studies the natural world. And therefore, you know, evolutionists say and anti-God folks say the only world that we have is the natural world. So we're just going to close everything into that box. And you can't step out of the box because we said you can't step out of the box. And so, therefore, God doesn't exist because we don't allow God to exist. And that's just foolishness, of course. And it has nothing to do with faith. It has, well, I mean, it has something to do with faith that there is no God. But you're trying to, in essence, use science to prove something that science was never designed to prove in the first place.
Does the same principle apply to evolution, which to many, and we talked about it here, that's an alternate faith system.
Well, evolution, for example, you already are saying that, hey, you know, the reason why we have all of these animals, and look at man, he's just another animal, but he's a much more sophisticated animal because he evolved from apes, and it took him a long time, but eventually he got there. You have a belief system that indeed was the process for man's you know, appearance here on Earth, and for animals' appearance here on Earth, because everything evolved from something else. The problem comes in when there's a dearth of information or a dearth of evidence to show that one species evolved into another species. Yes, we have variation on the kind, of course, and we have all the finches that Charles Darwin found on his one trip, his only trip to the Galapagos Islands, and he drew all these finches, and some finches had small beaks, and other finches had large beaks, depending on which island he was on. But it was all, they were all birds, and they were all finches. And so, you know, to say that, voila, here's the process for one creature evolving into another, he certainly didn't prove it. And the further we get down, the more we know about science, the more we know that, hey, everything seems to be kind of created, you know, separately, and things don't really look like they evolved. Things look like they're designed, and they're designed for their specific purpose that they have here on Earth. And so the more you delve into the reality of things, the more you find that, hey, science proves what the Bible says, that things are created. And, of course, we know who the creation is if you happen to read the Bible, because you know it's the God of creation that created everything. And the things didn't just happen because there was a big explosion sometime back in the eons of time. And then everything, you know, kind of fell into place.
Another question then, if there is error in science, is it because of empirical evidence that has not been discovered or thought of or considered, or is it because there is also a wealth of non-empirical evidence that really needs to be part of the picture? Now, that's kind of a metaphysical question, but in matters of God and faith, do we have everything at our fingertips so that empirical evidence is enough to establish the reality of God, or do we have to go beyond that? Because you're indicating that there's a barrier there.
Well, you know, the there is a barrier. However, if even reading scripture, the heavens declare the glory of God, and so, you know, God designed things so that when we look and investigate, we see God. We see evidence of his creation. We see evidence of design. And we know, again, from engineering, that in order to have a complex system, someone had to design it. And so we have extremely complex systems all around us, not to mention ourselves. And just take our immune system, for example. It is extremely complex, and it's just not made up of one component. It's, we have antibodies, we have T cells, we have macrophages, we have different types of macrophages, and all of these different things that work together in order to help, keep us well. And then when we do get, an outside invader like a bacteria or a virus or something, that the immune system, kicks into gear to attack it. I mean, it is just a remarkable system in and of itself. Or take the human eye, for example, and how the human eye, translates light, for example, into images, and then we can visualize those images inside of our brains, and we can be guided by those images. For example, and if you have two eyes that are working okay, then you have depth perception. And why do we have depth perception? It's because we have two eyes. If we only had one eye, we wouldn't have depth perception. So everything you look at within the creation, screams a creator. And science should lead us closer to God, not further away. But it is the assumptions that are made that leads, scientists astray. And that's where, folks fall down. It's not the evidence. It's not the observable world around us. It's not the nature itself. But it's the assumptions that goes in interpreting what people find and the experiments that they run. And then interpreting those experiments to say, oh, this is what it means because, this is how I believe. And so, therefore, I have proven that evolution actually works and exists.
And those assumptions are not necessarily scientific in nature, because they can be affected by any other aspect of our existence: intellect, political leanings, family history, culture. How far back does science go? When did man start becoming scientific? I know that's a very general question, but I suspect there was science before there was the Oxford English Dictionary.
Well, yeah, that is that's a loaded question. I mean, you want to go back to Socrates or some of the early Greeks, because to build a building, you have to understand something about the world around you, and to have pillars and then to start forming some type of structure. Even the Egyptians, to build the pyramids, had to use some, you would call it engineering today, but they would have to understand that, certain things fit together. The things that we don't understand, for example, or that we just kind of take for granted, the early Egyptians performed cataract surgery. Now, it's not the cataract surgery that we have today, but they did have a brass rod or poker that they understood that the lens became cloudy the older you got, and then you would be blind. But if they would, poke out the lens, that is, poke it out of its position, it would still be in your eye. then you could see at least some things. Of course, you didn't have lenses to correct the vision, but you could then see again and maybe not bump into as many walls as you were bumping into. So, and the Egyptians had batteries, and, you know, so we go back and we look at those, you know, that type of civilization, and we say, wow, okay, they were fairly sophisticated. Well, you know, if you believe in devolution, that is, we're getting more stupid than more intelligent as we go on, then it would make sense that, you know, people were pretty smart back then and could figure out the world around them and then use the, what they figured out in order to, you know, have
see, I knew we would work our way around to Dr. Don's theory of devolution. We haven't brought that up in a while. But it rings true. It strikes me that engineering is basically applied science. In other words, there are observations as to what materials are strong and what shape makes things stronger and arches. And that goes way back before a definition of science or maybe just the definition of the scientific method. Science seems to be a natural undertaking, whether you're studying the heavens and seeing patterns and establishing years, because the sun appears in the same place 365 and a quarter days later, you learn from observations, and then you apply that to certain things. That's as old as man.
Yeah, and so that's what we... Yeah, it's just that is definitely applied science. There's no doubt about it. But so it has been around for a long time. Man has been curious about his environment for a long time. The sad thing is that our cities are so polluted with light, for example, we can't see the stars in the heavens. But if you go way out in, you know, you go out in the desert or something here in Texas, you go to the west and you go out to desert where there's little, let's say, light pollution from a big city, you look up and the heavens are filled with stars and with galaxies and with, you know, all kinds of stuff. And we can see the Milky Way, and it's like, wow, you know, I didn't know that there was all of this out there. And, you know, there's trillions and trillions of stars, you know, in the sky. And so those type of things, of course, the early Christians and certainly the Jews could see that. And, you know, we have lost a lot because of the environment that we live in, you know, today. So
I remember going out as a child and looking at a solar eclipse. My mom and dad were so excited about this, and they smoked small pieces, rectangles of glass, so we could safely observe this. Doing things like that motivated me to get into science in school. Math and science was what I loved, and it's what I excelled in the early years in particular. I'm wondering these days what motivates a young person to be a scientist. It was so easy to stare at the stars in the sky and say, there's something bigger than me here at work. Now that seems to be more complicated.
Yes, it is. Now you have, you know, you have a lot of guys, for example, that want to go into computer science because they've been playing computer games and they want to design, you know, their computer, you know, the next best thing in computer games. Because that's what they're exposed to, unfortunately. And observational science and, you know, sophisticated engineering is being lost, at least in this country, because we're not necessarily promoting it in our youth, in our youngsters. I mean, I had a, from the early, not the earliest age, I mean, I wasn't 1 year old, but, you know, I can remember having a chemistry set, and I couldn't get enough chemicals to play around with in the garage with the chemistry. chemistry set. I took apart televisions and radios to figure out, you know, how they worked. And I got shocked several times to mm-hmm. know that, you know, you just don't touch that, even if it's unplugged, because of such a thing as a capacitor, you know, that retains energy. And so, you know, it's you kind of learn by getting your hands into things and, you know, doing those type of things. I mean, I took apart, you know, engines and worked on cars when I was in high school and you know, that there, and then worked on cars when I was in college out of necessity, because I didn't have a whole lot of money to say, here, fix my car. I could fix it for a fraction of the cost that you could take it to a repair shop, you know, and fix it. So,
you know what, it strikes me that now one of the big changes, you brought up the digital world and computers, that seems to be not the real world. It seems to insulate us from the real world. And I'm wondering if that isn't a great misdirection in our intellectual development as humans.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, you had to find your own fun, mm-hmm. and you had to keep yourself busy, whether it be playing ball or, like I said, doing a chemistry set or painting pictures or whatever it is, you had to find your own entertainment. Now you've got that entertainment all on a smart, you know, cell phone. And you can play games on it. You can watch videos, and you know, most of this stuff is mind numbing. It's a mind numbing experience instead of you know, expanding our experiences. It's keeping us as little children, it's if you will,
little more than developing. little more than diversion.
Yes, and so. Who then, you know, so it's easier, if you really think about this, it's easier to control a population that has been brought up like that, because you can then direct what they watch, what they interact with, and then kind of direct their thoughts along a certain pattern that you want them to think.
Yeah, but who would want to do that? Who would want to do that?
Those people who want to control other people. You know, those people that think that they are gods, because after all, they don't believe in God. So they want to be little gods. And so they can control other people by these types of means. So the worst thing that we can do, certainly for our kids, is allow them to delve into this type of activity all the time. I mean, okay, give them an hour, maybe, depending on their age. I certainly wouldn't give a smartphone to a child. You know, they would have to be 15 or 16, you know, before I would give them, and possibly even 18 or 19 or 20, because the mind, the youthful mind, wants to explore the environment. And if you're controlling the environment with one of those things, then you're controlling what they're going to be thinking down the road. And so I think a lot of parents make the mistake of supplying these devices to keep the child occupied, rather than saying, go out and explore the world and, you know, find the four-leaf clover for yourself and look at the bugs and those type of things, rather than looking on their smartphones.
Yeah, good point. And you've made it too interesting, Don, because we don't have time to get into the dinosaur footprints article. Maybe we can do that next week. But this has been fascinating. And a look at ordinary intellectual activity and comparing it to scientific activity may be the next step here. And I think we all engage in science from year one. Is we observe things around us and we react to them in certain ways. Sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's pleasurable. And we learn from that whole process. And that's a God-given thing. That isn't learned in school. That comes as part of the package.
It is, and trying to understand and unravel the world around us is innate in every human being.
Don is a member of the board at Creation Moments and would like to recommend their website to you. It's creationmoments.com. And there's scientific information there that supports and establishes and explains the biblical story of creation. You can start with the Bible, but then you can pick up the information you find there and find that it's all confirmed by science. And that's a helpful thing, creationmoments.com. Don, we're grateful to you. We'll see you next week. Have a good week.
All right. Sounds good.
Bye-bye.
Very interesting, Don.
So long.